I wondered if it made people any better because I had seen so many monks who were very devout, very devoted indeed to their service attendances, but away from the temples, away from the services, they were sadistic bullies. Yet others who never went near the temples were kind-hearted and considerate, and would always do something to help the poor bewildered small boy who didn't know what to do next and who was always afraid of getting into trouble because so many adults hated to be asked things by small boys. I looked to the center of the temple, the center of the lamastic group, and I looked at our revered, beloved inmost one sitting there serene and calm with a very strong aura of spirituality. And I resolved that I would at all times try to model myself on him and on my guide the Lama Minya Dondup. The service went on, and I am afraid that I must have fallen asleep behind one of the pillars because I knew nothing more until there was the loud ringing of bells and the roaring of conches again, and then the sound as of a multitude rising to their feet and the indefinable noises which a lot of men make when they are making for an exit. So I rubbed my eyes with my knuckles, and tried to look intelligent, tried to look awake and as if I had been paying attention. Wearily I went along, again at the tail end, to our common dormitory, thinking how glad I was that after this night I should not be sleeping with a whole crowd of boys who rent the night with their snores and cries, but after this night I should be able to sleep alone. In the dormitory, as I prepared to wrap myself in my blanket, a boy was trying to talk to me, saying how wonderful he thought it was that I was going to have a place of my own. But he yawned heavily in the middle of his sentence and just fell to the ground sound asleep. I walked to the window wrapped in my blanket, and looked out again at the starry night, at the spume of snow tearing away from the mountain tops and lit most beautifully by the rays of the rising moon. Then I, too, lay down and slept, and thought of nothing. My sleep was dreamless and peaceful. Chapter 11. Together we walked down the corridors until at last we reached the inner courtyard where monk grooms were already holding two horses, one for my guide the Lama Minya Dondup and the other for unfortunate me. My guide motioned to a groom to help me mount, and I was glad my legs were bad because a horse and I rarely arrived at the same point together. If I went to mount a horse, the horse moved and I fell to the ground, or if I expected the horse to move and took a cunning jump, the horse did not move and I jumped right over the wretched creature. But this time, with the excuse of my injured legs, I was helped upon that horse, and immediately I did one of those things which are not done. I started riding away without my guide. He laughed out loud as he saw me, knowing that I had no control over that unfortunate horse. The horse strode away out of the courtyard and down the path, I clutching on for dear life, afraid of rolling over the mountainside. Around by the outer wall I rode. A fat and friendly face peered out of a window just above and called, "Goodbye, Lobsang, come again soon, we'll have some fresh barley in next week, good stuff, better stuff than we've been having lately. You call and see me as soon as you come." The cook monk heard another horse coming and turned his eyes leftwards, and let out an owl. I, honorable medical lama, forgive me. My guide was coming and the poor cook monk thought he had taken an impertinence, but my guide's friendly smile soon put him at ease. I rode off down the mountain, my guide chuckling behind me. "We shall have to coat the horse with glue for you, Lobsang," he chortled. I looked back rather glumly at him. It was all right for him, he was a big man, some 6 feet tall and more than 200 pounds in weight, he had muscles, he had brains, and I had no doubt that if he felt like it he could pick up that horse and carry it down the mountainside instead of the horse carrying him. I, on the other hand, felt like a fly perched on the creature. I had little control over the thing and every so often, out of the perverseness of its nature and knowing that I was scared stiff, it would go to the very edge of the path and stare straight down at the willow grove so far below, neighing presumably with amusement as it did so. We reached the bottom of the mountain and went along the Dobdal road because before going on to Chakpori we had a call to make in one of the offices of the government in the village of Sho. Arrived there, my guide very considerately tied my horse to a post and lifted me off saying, "Now you just stay around here, Lobsang. I shall be not more than 10 minutes." He picked up a bag and strode off into one of the offices, leaving me sitting on a pile of stones. The, said a countrified voice behind me. I saw the Lama of the Saffron Robe get off that horse, and here is his boy to look after the horses. How do you do, young master? I looked around and saw a small group of pilgrims. They had their tongues out in the traditional Tibetan greeting with which the inferiors greeted their superiors. My chest swelled with pride. I basked unashamedly in the glory reflected from being the boy of the Lama of the Saffron Robe. Oh, was my reply. You should never come upon a priest unexpectedly like that. We are always engaged in meditation, you know, and a sudden shock is very bad for our health. I frowned rather disapprovingly as I looked towards them and continued, my master and guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, the wearer of the Saffron Robe. One of the most important lamas here. He is a very great person indeed, and I should not advise you to get too near his horse, because his horse, too, is important bearing such a great rider. But get along now, get along, don't forget your circuit of the ring road, it will bring much good to you. With that I turned away, hoping that I had acted as a true monk should, hoping that I had made a favorable impression. A chuckle nearby me made me look up rather guiltily. A trader was standing there picking at his teeth with a piece of straw, one hand on hip, the other hand very busy with his mouth. Hastily I looked round and saw the pilgrims had, as ordered, continued on their round. Well? What do you want? I said to the old trader who was peering at me through screwed one-ip eyes, his face seamed and wrinkled with the years. I have no time to waste, I said. The old fellow smiled benignly. Now, young master, don't be so harsh to a poor old trader who has such a difficult time making a living in these hard, hard days. Do you happen to have any trinkets with you, anything that you have brought from the big house up above there? I can offer you a very good price for cuttings from a llama's hair or for a piece of a llama's robe. I can offer you a better price for anything that has been blessed by one of the higher llamas, such as your master of the Saffron Robe. Speak up, young master, speak up before he comes back and catches us. I sniffed as I looked at him and thought, no, not if I had a dozen robes would I sell for things to be traded by fakes and charlatans. Just then, to my joy, I saw my guide coming. The old trader saw him too and made off with a shambling gait. What are you trying to do, buy up traders? Asked my guide. No, honorable master, was my response. He was trying to buy up you or any bits or pieces of you, hair, pieces, robe clippings, or anything which he thinks I should have been able to steal from you. The Lama Minya Dondup laughed, but there was a rueful sort of ring to his laugh as he turned and stared after the trader who was not tarrying but really hurrying to get out of calling range. It is a pity these fellows are always on the make. It is a pity they try to get something and give it a false value. After all, it is not the saffron robe that matters, but the soul of the wearer of the saffron robe. So saying, he lifted me in one swift easy motion and put me astride my horse, which looked as surprised as I felt. Then he untied the reins, giving them to me, as if I knew what to do with them, and mounting his own horse we rode off. Down the Manulakhand we went, past the rest of the village of Sho, past the Pargotling, and then over the little bridge which spanned a tributary of the Kling Chu. We took the next turn left, passing the small Kundu Park, and taking the next road left to our own Chakpurai. This was a rough and stony road, a hard road to traverse, a road which needed a sure-footed horse. Iron Mountain, as was our name for Chakpurai, is higher than the mountain on which the Potala is erected, and our pinnacle of rock was smaller, sharper, steeper. My guide led the way, his horse every so often dislodging small stones which rolled down the path towards me. My horse followed, carefully picking a path. As we rode up I looked over to my right, to the south, where flowed the happy river, the Kyai Chu. I could also see straight down into the Jewel Park, the Norbulinga, where the inmost one had his very few moments of recreation. At present the park was very much deserted except for a few monk gardeners straightening up after the recent tempest. There were no senior lamas in sight. I thought how, Before my legs were damaged, I liked to slither down the mountainside and duck across the Linkor Road and go into the Jewel Park or Norgulinga by what I thought was my own super secret way. We reached the top of the mountain, we reached the stony space before the Chakpori walls, walls which enclose the whole of that lamasery. The monk at the gate quickly welcomed us in, two other monks hurried to take our horses from us. I parted from mine with the greatest of joy, but groaning somewhat as the weight fell upon my legs once again. "I shall have to see about your legs, Lobsang, they are not healing so well as I expected," said my guide. A monk took the lama's luggage and hurried off with it. He turned and made his way into the lamasery, calling over his shoulder, "I will see you again in an hour's time." The potala was too public for me, too grand. One always had to be alert in case one accidentally annoyed a senior monk or a junior lama. The senior lamas never took offense, they had greater things to worry about than whether a person was looking in their direction or apparently ignoring them. As in all cases, it is only the inferior men who create commotions. Their superiors were kind, considerate, and understanding. I wandered into the courtyard, thinking that this would be a good opportunity to have a meal. At that stage of my career, food was one of the most important things because Tsampa, with all its virtues, still left one feeling quite a bit hungry. As I walked the well-known corridors, I met many of my contemporaries, boys who had entered at much the same time as I had. But now there was a great change. I was not just another boy, not just another young lad to be trained or to be fought with. Instead, I was under the special protection of the great Lama Minya Dondup, the wearer of the saffron robe. Already rumor had leaked out and spread abroad that I was going to be specially taught. That I was going to have a room in the Lama's quarters, that I was going to do this, that I was going to do that, and I was amused to notice that my exploits, real or imagined, were already well known. One boy chortled gleefully to another that he had actually seen me picked up from the ground by a great gust of wind and blown up onto the top of the golden roof. "I saw it with my very own eyes," he said. "I was standing here at this very spot and I saw him down there sitting on the ground. Then this great dust storm came and I saw Lobsang sailing upwards. He looked as if he was fighting devils on the roof." Then, the boy paused dramatically and rolled his eyes for emphasis. "And then, he fell down right into the arms of one of the temple keeper lamas." There was a sigh of awe, admiration, and envy all mixed up, and the boy continued, "And then Lobsang was taken to the inmost one, which brought distinction and honor to our class." I pushed my way through the throng of sensation seekers, the horde of small boys and junior monks who were hoping that I would make some startling announcement, a sort of revelation from the gods, but I was in search of food. I pushed my way through the throng and stumped off down the corridor to a well-known spot, the kitchen. "Ah. So you've returned to us, eh? Well, sit ye down, lad, sit ye down, I'll feed you up well. You've not been too well fed at the potala by the look of you. Sit ye down and I'll feed you." The old cook monk came and patted my head and pushed me back so that I was sitting on a pile of empty barley sacks. Then he just fished inside my robe and managed to get my bowl. Off he went, carefully cleaning my bowl already, not that it needed it, and off to the nearest of the cauldrons. Soon he was back slopping tsampa and tea all over the place, making me draw up my legs in case I got it over my robe. "There, there, boy," he said, pushing the bowl into my hands. Eat it up because I know you will be sent for soon. The abbot wants to hear all about what happened." Fortunately, someone else came in and wanted attention, so he turned away from me and went off, leaving me to eat my tsampa. With that matter disposed of, I thanked him politely because he was a good old man who thought that boys were nuisances, but they were not such nuisances if they were fed properly. I went to the great bin of fine sand and carefully cleaned my bowl once again, taking the broom and sweeping up the sand which I had spilled on the floor. I turned and bowed in his direction, to his pleased surprise, and made my way out. I went to the end of the corridor and rested my arms against the wall while I peered out. Below me was the swamp, a bit beyond that was the flowing stream. but I was looking over the cash island at towards the ferry because the boatman appeared to be most uncommonly busy today. He was there standing up leaning on his oars, pushing away at them working hard, and his yak-skin boat seemed to be absolutely laden down with people and their bundles, and I wondered what it was all about, why there were so many people flocking to a holy city. Then I remembered the Russians. The Russians had been putting a lot of pressure on our country because the British had been making a commotion also, and now the Russians were sending a lot of spies into Lhasa disguised as traders and thinking that we poor ignorant natives would never know. They forgot, or perhaps never even knew, that many of the lamas were telepathic and clairvoyant and knew what they were thinking almost as soon as they themselves knew. I love to stand and watch and see all the different types of people, and to divine their thoughts, determine whether they were good or bad. With practice it was easy, but now was hardly the time for standing staring at others. I wanted to go and see my guide, I wanted to be able to lie down. My legs were hurting me and I really was tired. My guide had had to go away to the wild rose fence before I was really well enough to get about my business. Actually, I should have been between my blankets on the floor for another week, but the Chakpori, good place though it really did not welcome small boys who were ill, who had wounds which were slow to heal, and who broke the regular routine. So it was that I had had to go to the Potala where there were, curiously enough, more facilities for such attentions than in our temple of healing. At Chakpori suitable students were taught the healing arts. We were taught all about the body, how the different parts of the body work. We were taught acupuncture in which very thin needles are pushed into the body to stimulate certain nervous centers, and we were taught about herbs, how to gather herbs after having been able to identify them, how to prepare them, store them and dry them. In the Chakpori we had large buildings in which monks under the supervision of lamas were always preparing ointments and herbs. I remembered the first time that I had seen them. I peered through the doorway, hesitant, scared, not knowing what I would see, not knowing who would see me. I was curious because, although my studies had not yet reached the state of herbal medicine, I was still vastly interested. So, I peered. The room was large, it had a high, raftered roof, and from great beams which stretched from side to side and held up a triangular arrangement of frames, ropes descended. For a time I looked, not being able to understand the purpose of those ropes. Then as my eyes became sharp, but in the somewhat dim interior I saw that the other end of the ropes were attached to leather bags which by suitable treatment were as hard as wood. Each leather bag had a word painted on it, words which meant not a thing to me. I watched and no one took any notice of me until at last an old lama turned and saw me. He smiled quite kindly and said, "Come in, my boy, come in. I am pleased indeed to see that one so young is already taking an interest. Come in." Hesitantly I walked towards him, and he put a hand on my shoulder and to my amazement he started telling me about the place, pointing out the different herbs, telling me the difference between herb powder, herb tea, and herb ointment. I liked the old man, he seemed to have been remarkably sweetened by his herbs. Just in front of us there was a long table of stone, a rather rough type of stone. I would not like to say what sort of stone it was, but it was probably granite. It was level and about 15 feet by 6 feet, one large solid slab. Along its sides monks were very busy spreading herb lumps, that is the only word I can find to describe them because they seem to be clotted lumps of herbs, a mass of brownish vegetation. They spread these herbs on the table, and then with flat pieces of stone something like bricks, they pressed down on the herbs dragging the stone towards the side. As they lifted I found that the herbs were being macerated, shredded. They kept on and kept on at it until it seemed that only a fibrous pulp was left. When they reached that stage they stood back and other monks approached with leather pails and stones with a serrated edge. Carefully the fresh lot of monks scraped the stone bench, scraped all the fibrous matter into their leather pails. With that done, the original monks spread fine sand on the bench and started rubbing it with their stones, cleaning it and at the same time making fresh scratches which would hold the herbs so that they could be shredded. The monks with their leather pails took the fibrous material to the far side of the large room where, I now saw, there were steaming cauldrons of water. One after the other they took their pails and emptied the contents into one of the cauldrons. I was interested to see that it had been bubbling and steaming, but as soon as the new fibrous stuff was put in the boiling point stopped. The old lama took me across and looked in, and then he picked up a stick and stirred the stuff, saying, "Look. We are boiling this, and we are keeping on boiling it until the water boils off and we get a thick syrup. I will show you what we do with that." He led me across to another part of the hall, and there I saw great jars full of syrup all labeled with their different identities. "This," he remarked, pointing to one particular jar, "is what we give to those suffering from catarrhal infections. They have a small amount of this to drink and, while the taste is not very pleasant, it is much more pleasant than the catarrh. Anyway, it cures them." He chuckled in high good humor, and then led me to another table in an adjacent room. Here I found that a group of monks were working on a stone bench. It seemed to be a shallow trough. They had wooden paddles in their hands and they were mixing up a whole collection of things under the supervision of another lama. The old lama who was giving me such a pleasant conducted tour said, "Here we have oil of eucalyptus, together with oil of camphor. We mix that with some highly expensive imported olive oil, and then with these wooden paddles the monks stir everything up and mix it with butter. The butter forms a fine base for an ointment. When we have people with chest afflictions they find fine relief when this is rubbed on their chest and back." Gingerly I stretched out a finger and touched a blob of their stuff on the edge of the trough. Even more cautiously I sniffed it and I even felt my eyes going crossed. The smell seemed to burn right through me. It seemed as if my lungs were going to burn inside out, and I was afraid to cough, although I badly wanted to, in case I should explode. The old lama laughed and laughed as he said, "Now put that on your nose and it will take the skin out of your nostrils. That is the concentrated stuff. It has to be diluted yet with more butter." Farther along monks were stripping the tips off the leaves of a certain dried plant, and carefully sifting it through a cloth which was like a very close mesh net. These monks are preparing special teas. By tea we mean an admixture of herbs which can be drunk. "This particular tea," he turned and pointed, "is an antispasmodic tea and it gives relief in cases of nervous twitchings. When you come here and take your turn at all this you will find it extremely interesting." Just then someone called to him, but he said before leaving, "Look around, my boy, look around. I am glad indeed to see one who is so interested in our arts." With that he turned and hurried off to the other room. I wandered about taking a sniff of this and a sniff of that. I took one particular powder and sniffed it so much that it got up my nostrils and down my throat, and made me cough and cough and cough, until another lama came and gave me a drink of tea. Beastly stuff it was, too. I recovered from that incident and walked to a far wall where there was a great barrel. I looked at it and I was amazed because it seemed to be full of a bark, a curious looking bark, bark such as I had never seen before. I touched a piece and it was grumbly to my fingers. I put my head sideways in some astonishment because I couldn't see what use there would be for such dirty old pieces of bark, rougher and dirtier than anything I had seen in any of our parks. A lama looked at me, came over and said, "So you've not any idea what this is, eh?" "No, honor able medical lama," I replied, "it seems to me to be just rubbish." He laughed at that. He really was highly amused as he said, "That, young man, is a bark which is used for the most common ailment in the world today, a bark which gives relief and which has saved many lives. Can you guess what it is? What is the most common ailment?" He really had me puzzled there, and I thought and thought, and just could not come up with any sensible solution, and I told him so. He smiled as he told me, "Constipation, young man, constipation. The biggest curse of the world. But this is a sacred bark which we import by traders from India. It is called sacred bark because it comes from a very, very distant country, Brazil, where they call it cascara sagrada, that is, bark sacred. We use it, again, as a tea, or in exceptional cases we boil and boil and boil until we have a distillate which we mix up with a certain collection of chalk and sugars, and then we press it into a pill form. That is for the ones who cannot take its acrid taste as a tea. He smiled quite kindly at me, obviously pleased at my interest, and it really was interesting. The old lama whom I had first met came hurrying back, asking me how I was managing, and then he smiled as he saw that I was still handling a bit of Cascara Sagrada. "Chew it, my boy, chew it. It will do you a lot of good. It will cure any cough that you have because you will be afraid to cough after chewing that." He chortled away like a small elf, because although he was a high medical lama he was still a small man in stature. Over here," he said, "look at this, this is from our own country. Slippery elm, we call it. The bark of the slippery elm. A very useful thing for people who have gastric disturbances. We mix it up, we make a paste of it, and the unfortunate sufferer takes the stuff and it relieves his pain. But you wait, my boy, you wait. When you come here a little later on I am sure that we shall discover that you have a great future ahead of you." I thanked him and the other lama for their kindness, and then I left after the first of many visits. But hurrying footsteps, a boy was coming with the order for me to go to my guide the Lama Miniadon Up, who was awaiting me in his own quarters and which now would be almost mine, because I was going to have a room next door to him. So I wrapped my robe tightly about me trying to look tidy again and hurried off as fast as I could, hurried off to see what sort of place I was going to have. Chapter 12. Milne was a pleasant room, small, but still large enough for my requirements. I was gratified indeed to notice that I had two low tables, and one of those low tables had quite a number of magazines and papers on it. On the other table there were some very nice things laid out for me, those sweet things of which I so heartily approved. As I entered, a monk attendant smiled at me and said, "The gods of fortune have certainly smiled upon you, Lobsang. You are right next door to the High Lama Miniadon Dup." I knew that. He was telling me things I already knew, but then he said, "Here is a communicating door. You must remember never to enter that door without permission from your guide, because he may be in deep meditation. Now you cannot see your guide for a little time, so I suggest you get down to that food." With that he turned and left my room. My room. It sounded good. It was a wonderful thing to have a room of my own after having had to sleep very publicly with a lot of other boys. I walked across to the table, bent down and carefully examined all the good things displayed there. After a frenzy of uncertainty I decided which I would have, a sort of a pink thing with a white dusting on top. I picked it up with my right hand and then for good measure I picked up another with my left hand, then I went to the window to see just where I was in the building. I rested my arms in the stone of the recessed window frame and poked my head outside, muttering a very unfortunate word as I dropped one of my Indian cakes in the process. Hastily I gobbled up the other lest it, too, should share that fate. Then I returned to my scrutiny of the landscape. Here, I was at the extreme southeastern part of the building. I had the last room right on the corner of the annex. I could see the jewel park, the Norbulinga. At present there were a number of lamas poking about, they seemed to be having a debate, making quite a number of gestures. For a few idle moments I watched them, they were quite amusing. One was posturing on the ground and the other was declaiming to him, then they changed places. Oh! Exclamation mark. Yes, I knew what they were doing, they were rehearsing for the public debates because the Dalai Lama himself was going to take part in a public lamastic debate. Satisfied that I had not missed anything that I should know about, I turned to other things. A few pilgrims were pottering about on the Lingkor Road, pottering about as if they expected to find gold beneath every bush or beneath every stone. They were a motley collection. Some of them were orthodox pilgrims, really sincere, others, as I could tell without much trouble, were spies, Russian spies who were spying upon the Chinese and us, and Chinese spies who were spying on the Russians and on us. I thought that as long as they spied upon each other they might leave us alone. Right below my window was a swamp with a little river running through it and emptying into the Happy River. There was a bridge over the river which carried the Linkor Road. I watched in some amusement because there was a small group of towns boys there, blackheads, we called them, because they hadn't shaven heads as we monks had. They were fooling about on this bridge, throwing little bits of wood over one side and dashing across to the other side to see them reappear.